Welcome to the AI Scene, where we explore how AI is impacting the world. I created it in homage to Aristotle Lyceum in Athens, which explored various topics. I'm Samraj Bhavaru, certified AI ethicist and visiting lecturer at Durham University. Each episode, I speak with leaders who have unique ideas or tools around AI for us to learn from. And today, I'm joined by the esteemed Professor Jim Lisinski, who is an award-winning clinical professor of marketing at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, where he teaches popular courses on marketing strategy, AI in marketing and omnichannel marketing, and was named 2022 Kellogg Professor of the Year. He's a recognized expert, in-demand consultant, and keynote speaker with over 30 years of marketing industry experience, including a notable 12-year career at Google, where he was Vice President of Customer Solutions for the Americas. Jim's seminal book about the new marketing model, Winning the Zero Moment of Truth, known as ZMOT or ZMOT, was published in 2011 and has been read by over 300,000 marketers worldwide and was featured in the New York Times, Advertising Age, and Forbes. His latest project, the AI Marketing Canvas, a five-step AI plan for marketers, was first published by Stanford University Press in 2021 and has been named both a top AI book and a top business book. The newly revised second edition is being released in the next few weeks in December. So welcome, Jim. Did I cover everything off?
Hi, Samraj. Greetings from Chicago. Nice to be with you. Thrilled to be here today.
No problem. And is it quite windy there at the moment?
Always so, yes.
Yeah, and one of the biggest wins we've seen in the last 2 years is AI. How has that impacted your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy, right, to think that we are sitting here talking in November of 2025, just at the three-year anniversary of the, I guess, public launch of ChatGPT. Of course, you and I and your viewers and listeners know that AI didn't just start 3 years ago, right? It started in 1950 with the great Alan Turing, speaking of UK, British. And so, I've been kind of focused on this area for quite a long time. As you were kind enough to mention, the first book came out pre-ChatGPT, and I've been really deep into this topic since probably 2018 or 2019 as my focus area. But it's been amazing to see how, now all the popular press, every business conversation, lots of content being published around it, some things insightful and truthful, and some things maybe a bit of snake oil we can talk about. But here we are, all AI all the time, it seems like.
Yeah, and it's impacting marketing, right? Because obviously marketing is about sending a message to people. And I think because it's a large language model, the language part of the model is quite important for us because it's how we define it. But do you think it's a silver bullet for advertisers at the moment?
Well, silver bullet might be a little bit of an overstatement. I don't know that anything ever is the proverbial true full silver bullet. But what's really interesting about AI here, Samraj, if we boil this back down, and I'm going to maybe push off against, hey, we've heard this before, like AR and VR and blockchain and like all of these supposed precursor silver bullets. What's different about this one? What's different about this one is that the technology itself is so perfectly suited to what's center of the plate marketers' to-do lists every day. So if you think about both kind of old school, OG, left brain machine learning that predicts things based on data inputs, and then we'll call it newer school generative AI right brain that creates, well, prediction and analysis and generation and creation pretty much makes up everything on a marketer's to-do list. And we can talk about many of those things. But that's why I think it is so important for marketers to focus and become proficient and start applying it in marketing, because it's exactly in line with what we do.
Yeah, I think applying it to marketing is crucial, but I know that you're a big fan of working backwards from the business problem. So how would you advise a startup would use AI in their marketing?
Yeah, so that's right. I mean, I think the danger here with this sort of new set of technologies and tools, like with any new set of technologies or tools, is what we would in marketing, of course, call the proverbial shiny object syndrome, right? It's to sort of just chase, like, oh, I saw this vendor with some cool tool when I was at a conference, and now you run around from meeting to meeting trying to apply that tool. What is the old phrase? If the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, right? So we want to avoid that for sure. We want to avoid that. So I always advise, as you mentioned or alluded to, start with a business problem. And so here we call this, what is the use case for AI? And unfortunately, a lot of marketers don't have a clear set of use cases. A lot of the tool providers and agencies are now, even management consulting firms are now talking about, you know, I saw one the other day that was the 400 use cases for AI in marketing. And I don't know about you, Samraj, but I can't like keep 400 use cases live in the front of my brain from meeting to meeting. So I advise a simple 2x2, simple but powerful. On one axis is, what is the gain we're looking to extract from applying AI to marketing, the benefit, if you will. And on the other axis is, who is the beneficiary of that? So, you know, our 2x2 then becomes, are you looking to use AI to extract productivity or efficiency gains? Same thing we did before, but faster, cheaper, the same thing for less. Or are we looking to do something that we never physically or economically could have achieved before? That's true new to the world value creation. So those are the two kinds of benefit buckets. We can talk more about those if you like. And then who is the beneficiary is either my internal marketing team just behind my firewall, or and my consumers, my users, my customers externally. So we have productivity and value creation. We have internal and external. And there's the four use cases. That's the first conversation we need to have before we start talking about, hey, my cousin's friend's sister's roommate has a startup in Bulgaria and it's cool and we should use it.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I like your different axes, especially the fact that value is one of the crucial points. It's really hard to define what value means a lot of the time, because some people think it's profit in the short term. Some people think it's revenue. Some might think it's unlocking a new market. What would you define as a key value driver?
Yeah, well, you know, in my MBA marketing courses, we always talk about value creation as, you know, largely monetary value, but it could also be brand value, brand reputation, or brand equity over time. So you think about, you know, monetary value short term and long term would be revenue, profit, and share gains. But these are ways to use AI to not just do the same thing the same way with the same people and the same processes we always did, but a little faster. I mean, that's using AI as Henry Ford's proverbial faster horse, right? What we're talking about now is unlocking, rewiring our processes, doing things that never were before possible, doing things in different ways, which unlocks then that value creation.
Yeah, and it's really difficult sometimes to be authentic as a brand if you're doing the same thing everyone else is doing. So how does everybody keep that authentic edge in this AI era?
Yeah, and I get this question a lot from brand marketers when I speak at conferences and even when I post on LinkedIn. People say, isn't this sort of the race to mediocrity? If everybody has the same tools and everybody's trained the same way on the same tools, aren't we all going to have like this bland, mediocre, you know, AI slop output, and that's what marketing is going to devolve to? And I don't believe that. I say, as sort of a challenge or a pushback, well, all marketers already all have Excel and PowerPoint and SAP or Oracle or HubSpot or Google Search, right? I mean, we all have sort of the same tools today now, but yet there's still wide variation in, you know, the difference between excellent marketing, world-class marketing, and not great marketing. And so I think, you know, what this is going to do is it'll probably raise the ceiling and raise the floor, meaning, you know, for the average marketer or the below average marketer, it'll allow them to do some things better, more powerfully, more efficiently using AI. But it's also for those at the ceiling level, the world's greatest marketers, you know, the Coca-Colas of the world, the Starbucks of the world, who are already really great marketers, it'll allow them to do even greater things. So I don't see this as a sort of a race to the middle. I see it as a raise the ceiling, raise the floor moment.
I like that. It's quite a difficult thing to understand how to apply it to every single use case in business. And the way that I look at it is I look at it by revenue. I also look at it by unlocking new use cases or new customer groups. Because what we can find in advertising is if we have an algorithm or some sort of AI that optimizes for short-term sales, we can lose the chance to unlock new customer groups. So you've worked at Google. What would your advice be to people to make sure that they don't just focus on the short-term sales, but also unlock new revenue growth or new customer groups using AI?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a trap, right? That's the efficiency trap. You know, AI aside, just in any of our sort of marketing efforts, whether it's Instagram, Facebook, you know, TikTok, Google, et cetera, is sort of this race to the bottom of the alphabet metrics, you know, CPC, CPM, CPA, right? So, you know, if all I'm trying to do is lower my cost per click or cost per acquisition or cost per view, well, it's easy to sort of then drive that efficiency, but you shrink your business, right? You end up then with 10 customers at like a crazy high, LTV, crazy high CAC, crazy low CAC, right? But now you're shrinking your business that way. So what you should look at is the total profit pool that you're trying. Like, a marketer's job is to grow the business, right? You take profit to the bank. You don't take lower CPCs to the bank. I mean, then you end up with two customers at a 1 cent cost per click. Like, that's not what we're here to do. So I think, you know, even in a sort of the pre-AI era, that's always what I would say is like, how do we grow the business along the way? And very specifically then to your, you know, thought about search is, you know, I know it's anathema to many marketers to even have the conversation about Google Broad Match, but Broad Match, by the way, is one way that we can pulse open the aperture to not keep talking to the same smaller and smaller pool of customers more efficiently, but maybe also at the same time, you know, increase our reach. And that's, you know, we talk about mental and physical availability as one way, not the only way, but one way to grow the brand. So a broad reach is opening up that, you know, mental availability to a new pool of potential customers.
And speaking of mental availability and consideration, you're the inventor of ZMOT, which is Zero Moment of Truth, which is how customers are exploring options before they make a decision. And that's impacted right now, really, with the introduction of this zero-click era, which might change because OpenAI is going to introduce ads next year. So How did you come up with the ZMOT in your research at Google? And how do you see this changing as well as zero-click era being impacted?
Yeah, so the sort of reigning mental model for many marketers at that time, a decade ago, was the moments of truth model. And Procter & Gamble popularized this, but the first moment of truth was sort of that second that you're in front of the shelf at the store, and you decide which laundry detergent to put in the basket. And, you know, hopefully all of the marketers' previous work would come to roost at that moment, and they would pick your brand. And then the second moment of truth was when you would take the brand home and use it, and would it live up to all of the promises? Did it make your whites whiter and your brights brighter? And did it make your laundry smell fresh and clean? And so, you know, what we started to see with the advent of search and digital was that people just didn't go from TV advert to the grocery shelf or point of sale at the new car dealer or at the bank to open an account. They would actually do some research on their own. And so what we tried to do was, rather than saying that digital and search is some totally discontinuous, other different thing, we said, how does it fit into the marketer's mental model? And so if things were happening prior to that first moment of truth, driving path to purchase and decision making, well, first moment minus one gets us to zero moment, ZMOT or ZMOT, as we say in the US. And so we commissioned a large scale set of global research. And sure enough, that's what we were finding has borne out then and now, arguably even more so now, as there's much more opportunities for consumers to research and much less cost or friction to do so. So this is not just high ticket purchases like a vacation or, you know, an investment or a luxury product like a wristwatch or a handbag. You know, people now still go in search and now ask AI, hey, what's the best brand of olive oil for me to use in this recipe? And so actually Zero Moment has grown in importance over the last decade. And yeah, if you want, we can talk a little bit about what that means in a GEO, in a generative engine, or an AI world as we're moving into.
Yeah, that'd be really good, because if I'm searching for, let's say, this black t-shirt in Google AI mode or in ChatGPT or Perplexity, whatever it may be, it returns me results. We can't always understand how it thought about it. It gives us a chain of thought a lot of the time, but we don't always understand. So what are your thoughts on this process? How do consumers control, how do brands control what consumers see, and how do consumers control what they want to see?
Yeah. So we're in, I think, a transitional moment. We are in a moment where some of those engines are starting to experiment with ads. You know, there's experiments now running live on Amazon with Rufus on their ads that are in brand and product campaigns. Obviously, Google is testing ads at the bottom of AI search mode, as you alluded to earlier. Looks like our friends at ChatGPT, OpenAI, Sam Altman, you know, starting to move in that direction into 2026. But I think it's important for brands to remember a couple of things, like how do these results get returned? Well, there's sort of three steps that happen, and you can watch the engines think about this. But the first step is it checks its previously trained and coded memory. Again, these are like ChatGPT, generative pre-trained transformers. New version of Gemini, Gemini 3, for example, has training data that it knows embedded in its answers, we think up until the first part of 2025. So it may have already read an article, right, looked at a Reddit post, have some information that it knows about best olive oil. But of course, it also recognizes that your question might be of more time sensitive or more urgency. You may say best olive oil, November 2025. So all of these engines, of course, now have pathways to search the web for real-time news or new information beyond what its own memory knows. And so, you know, this is where some people say search doesn't matter anymore, search is going away. Well, search is now embedded within how an LLM gives you the answer, so of course it must matter. So that's the second step. And then the third step is you'll see sort of the last step. Gemini will come back and say sort of refining answer, selecting between options, optimizing the answer. And so it's scoring itself on a level of probability that it's giving you the right answer. So it weighs between a couple of different choices and refines it. Sometimes if you use ChatGPT, it might even show you both answers and ask you to pick which one or rate which one is better along the way. So, you know, this means three things. This means that we need to have good content out as a brand in a format that these engines, both technically, JSON packages and scripts like that, but as well as in a content-friendly way that they can digest and remember your brand as an answer. But remember, that's a long game. Like these engines are updated once a year, something like that. So if you start working on getting the right type of content out, you're not going to see that reflected in tomorrow's search results. However, doing things to continue to make sure that your actual search is good, that can have some short-term results. But I would also just say, you know, be very, very careful of anybody who's trying to tell you, dear viewer, that they have a magic bullet, to use your earlier term, that, you know, for some fee, they can instantly magically get your brand to show up tomorrow morning, guaranteed, right? Remember, there's variability in these searches. I can search on two different computers right in front of me at the same time, the same thing, and I'll get different answers back. So I think we just have to urge a little bit of ration and caution at this moment and not get sort of sucked into, you know, firms promising things that they can't really yet deliver.
One of the words you used there was a really good word, variability. And one word that I like to apply to agents and to AI is interpretability. Yeah. So if I give it a question, it will interpret the question, semantically understand it, and then go online, try to derive certain information, give it back to me after interpreting it yourself. So there's two or three points of interpretation. How does this impact how the internet works and how trust is in this era?
Yeah, and part of that interpretability might also be whether or not you gave that LLM permission to personalize, right? To remember all of your history and to return personalized results. So I can sit here with two machines, one with personalized history turned on, one with it turned off. You and I could sit next to each other with your history turned on and my history turned on, and we will get four different answers across those four machines. So yeah, I mean, I think it is very important for marketers to understand that, you know, sort of interpretability, contextual relevance, personalization are some very sophisticated, deep nuances here beyond sort of what we've experienced historically in returning Google search results. So, you know, I think this is a new frontier. We don't quite know where this is going to go. We imagine we'll get to paid, earned, and owned at some point, that we can, you know, now do some organic things to try within the rules of the engines to show up higher for our brand. And we'll have the opportunity to buy some ads. Although if you'd like to talk about ads in LLMs, does make me a little bit nervous, but we can talk about that if you want.
Yeah, sure. Why did it make you nervous?
Well, okay. Look, I think we all know, and most users know, that there are inherent biases, both good biases and negative biases, built into all of these LLMs, right? Bias has a negative connotation, but, you know, we want bias for the optimal answer, right? We don't want bias for a bad answer. But of course, the model makers have built in some of their own data biases, cultural biases, historical biases, et cetera, maybe even financial biases. So we know that they're not truly objective, but yet psychologically, we still have a willingness to trust the answer. When I ask it, like, you know, whatever, what is the best brand of razor? And it comes back and gives me a recommendation or two, we kind of trust that. On the other hand, if I were to ask it in a future state, what's the best brand of, you know, razor blade? And it would come back and say, while of course Gillette is the best brand, and they are actually on sale now at Waitrose or at Carrefour or at Amazon, click here to buy, hurry, offer ends soon. At that point, do we kill the golden goose, so to speak, because we just collapse the trust that's underneath this to provide us, I'll call it a semi-neutral or semi-objective answer. If the entire thing goes to pay to play, does it collapse, right, the value for end users?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I personally think that it's a good thing that they have this personalization through this context and conversations, but also I call it intimate data. Because it's got an intimate understanding of me if I ask it certain questions, and it's got a long-term history, and it's all got depth. And in Google search, there wasn't really ever depth. So I ask it a question, it returns all of the links, but I can't then converse around that specific point. So the context windows are very small, whereas now you can have the 2030 kind of back and forth for these tools. And I read yesterday that Google has, you know, trillions of tokens being fed into context windows, which is huge. And for those who are listening, a token is, let's say, one to one for a word for on average, let's say. So Jim would be one token, Lisinski would be a second token. And it's training on trillions of these to understand context. And yeah. So Jim, one of my perspectives, and you mentioned it, is on biases. So there's positive bias and negative bias. Ethics is going to be an increasingly growing area of concern for a lot of companies, or instead of the word concern, probably an area of focus. What do you see ethics being in this era, and for advertisers in particular, what do we have to be responsible for?
Yeah, I'm glad that you raised this. I think this is an important point because, you know, you asked earlier about what kinds of value do brands create. Well, they create certainly financial value, they create brand value, and I'll call it they should also be conscious of community value, right? Which is the collective good around what it is that we do. And this, of course, you know, famously came forward in the 2019 Executive Roundtable chaired by Jamie Dimon, right, from JPMorgan Chase, where he moved CEOs thinking beyond the sole purpose of a corporation is to maximize shareholder value, right? Because that would sort of say we could do whatever we want, even at the expense of brand and even at the expense of community value or ethics, right? Like if we could make another dollar to dump toxic byproducts in the river, that's the purpose of a corporation. And so I think this is just a good moment now, you know, 6 years hence from that executive roundtable release, invite people to go back and take a look at that and digest for themselves. Those three types of value act as sort of checks and balances, right? Like we need to make sure any action that we might take, yes, is it profit positive, but not at the expense of brand reputation, and certainly not at the expense of, I'll call it, community impact or value. And now we get into things, and you know, this is more your area as an ethicist, you know, than mine, Samraj. But you know, what kind of conversations are these engines having with people? What kind of influence are they having? What kind of emotional or psychological impact is it having? So I think we're in a moment now where I think it's just good to remind brands that it's not just about one more click and one more purchase. It's about, you know, keeping your brand equity, but also the impact on the constituents and communities you serve using these AI tools.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's why we have the ALI scene, right? As a free community for people to join for now.
Yeah.
And to exchange knowledge and wisdom and insights. So you used to work at Google, and obviously you must know Sundar Pichai is obviously the CEO of Google now. If you could give him any advice around what features to put into AI or the direction of change you want to see, what would it be?
Well, you know, far from me to offer Sundar direct advice. I mean, he's obviously a very capable executive. And, you know, if you look at the business results at Google, and even if you look at the recent products, I mean, Gemini 3, top of the charts on, you know, sort of every way that we evaluate LLMs, and the Nano Banana visual model as well, right? So, I mean, not that he needs my advice, but I guess my thought here would be for all of these folks, right? Don't lose sight of end user complexity, end user ease. And, you know, I'll back up a step. I think this was one of the things that ChatGPT 5.5.1 tried to do, which is, you know, I open up the tool and there's now like 11 models that I have to pick from. And I'm like model picker, and I don't even understand what these O3 is and what's different of O3 versus 4.0. And right. So naming convention, UI, workflow, ease of access. If these things really are going to go beyond a narrow set of power users into the torso and tail, you know, the long tail, to get your auntie and my cousin to use these things on a daily basis, not just some power users, I think it's not just about the tool, it's not just about the model, it's not just about the results, but I think we're going to move increasingly into an era where interface, UI, usability become increasingly important, and we're seeing moves in that direction from both OpenAI and Google with this latest release of their latest two models.
Yeah, I've seen all the news about Gemini 3, and it's really, really good. I've been using Nano Banana here and there. I agree. I was using an app the other day, and it's got so many models in there. I don't know what to do. There needs to be the invention of an agent that I can ask it to select the best model, or just inherently in these tools. I say, I want to do this. You do the rest. You pick the model. You pick the temperature. You pick the time. You pick everything and give it back to me whenever I need it.
That's right.
What we need. We need an assistant for the AI assistants.
Yeah, that's right. And increasingly, these firms are building that, right, on top of all of their underlying models here. But even, you know, like, really, do I have to sit there and pick through, do I want 5.1 thinking or do I want 5.1 fast? Well, I kind of want both, don't I? I want it to think and I want it to be fast. Why are you asking me, right? I'm not the, you know, PhD computer scientists who build these things. So this, I think you're echoing or underscoring my point for, you know, everyone building in this space, whether you are, you know, Sundar or Sam Altman, all the way down to startups. I think UI and usability is sort of the next phase of where kind of winners and volume and usage will be determined.
Yeah, I agree. And you mentioned at the start of this episode about snake oil salesmen. What are the common myths or things that you want to talk about that don't make sense at the moment with AI?
Well, I mean, I think a couple things that we can look at here. One is that it will just do everything for you. It will take over, that marketers are all going to be out of a job and there's no more careers in marketing. You know, there's always this hype when we get into any kind of new technology of, you know, the death of X or the death of Y. I don't buy that, right? I mean, I think what we've got here is an enabler, an enhancer. It's a great marketer. Times this great tool will get you greater results. It's not this tool instead of, and we can all, I don't know, retire and go on the beach and never work in marketing again. I think, as I said earlier, raise the ceiling, raise the floor. Keep in mind that great marketing great marketers who are trained well, who know how to ask questions, who understand the discipline of marketing, will benefit the most from these kinds of tools. So I would say that's number one. The second one is I would just, you know, say, be very careful of people who try to tell you that that success here comes from finding any little tiny startup that no one ever else has heard of. That's not really what a marketer should be doing. That leave that work to venture capitalists, who, by the way, can't even pick 2 out of 10, you know, winners in a portfolio that they invest in. Article today in the Wall Street Journal, for example, that, you know, Marriott invested in a digital key startup, and, you know, for room keys, and that startup went under, and now Marriott's in a tough spot. So, you know, there's some definite drawbacks of betting the farm on a little small startup that hasn't proven itself, that can't scale, that can't, you know, work globally to the scale of your business. And so, you know, I always advise marketers to first of all start by centering on one of the three frontier models as their main tool, right? So that's going to either be ChatGPT Enterprise, right? ChatGPT Teams, Gemini Enterprise, or of course, you know, the latest versions of Claude from Anthropic. That should be sort of the centerpiece of your tool set. The myth is, oh, those are just like consumer tools. We need our own 27 little specialized tools. Well, again, they're from startups that might not be around. How do those 27 little tools actually talk to each other? Well, now you got to bring Deloitte in with a 7-figure project to write integration code between those tools. Oh, guess what? And by the way, Google and Anthropic and Gemini and ChatGPT are increasingly putting those features in their frontier models anyway. So those would just be some of the things that I would think about. You know, it's easy to sort of chase little startups. It's easy to chase silver bullets. It's easy to believe the end of, the death of, but like, take a breath. And as our British friends say, stay calm and carry on, right?
Yeah, stay calm and carry on and keep using AI. So what was your wow moment with AI? What was the day that you used AI and you thought, wow?
So for me, I've had lots of wow moments along the way, but I've had a little sort of side passion project. Folks who follow me on LinkedIn see this. I've been creating the equivalent of a 1990s style TV sitcom, and it's called Aloha Dad. And I'm able, you know, through a couple of the Google tools, VO3 at the centerpiece of this, they're a video creation tool, to create and string together 8-second video clips of this, complete with laugh track and character continuity from scene to scene, where the Hawaiian style shirt that my main character wears, the pattern on it is exactly the same. The voice is exactly the same. And I just simply take those little clips and cut them together in good old iMovie, right? So that it strings together a trailer for this. And I just want you to think about this, Samraj. This would have taken hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? Weeks, if not months of effort to do something like this. So just imagine the for $19 a month, right, which I know is, you know, not insignificant for many folks and not insignificant in many parts of the world, but you have like this amazing PhD level, always on, never gets tired assistant that can do truly amazing transformational things that can make all of us, creators, entrepreneurs, right, business leaders, educators. It's amazing what these tools can do. And that little sitcom that I created was like, wow.
That is really cool. I've actually not had enough time to sit down and stitch things together, but I'm going to try that now. I'm going to try it. I'm going to try and have a character and stitch them in together. Because I wanted to make like a music video just for fun.
Yeah.
With these tools. And I think they're doing that right. They're stitching it together rather than doing one big prompt.
Yeah, no, absolutely so. And so, you know, whatever sort of set of tools that you want to use for this one, but they're out there in both, I would say, OpenAI's set of video tools as well as Google's set of video tools are a great place for your listeners to start. You know, I think that's one. And then the other thing that was just sort of a wow is, you know, now with the native agent that's embedded into ChatGPT, and, you know, a good one to do is to take your local pizzeria that's your favorite and just go into ChatGPT and ask it to order you a pizza whatever that is, a large vegetarian pizza or cheese and sausage or whatever your flavor is, from that restaurant and watch within ChatGPT as it will open up a mini browser. It'll go to the website. It'll click on order online. It'll configure your pizza. It'll pause and confirm it with you. It'll pause and ask for your credit card if you want to go ahead and configure that and confirm it. But to just like sit there hands off and watch the thing order you a pizza is also pretty stunning.
Yeah, it's a really cool thing. I actually remember when Alexa was brought out in 2011 or 12 or something, I bought the first ever version of the Alexa and I was using it and I thought, wow, this is amazing. I can talk to this AI thing. I thought that was the AI we see now. I thought that was going to be the breakthrough, but it didn't break through for some reason. I think now voice is coming back because of this text-based approach and text has opened up the doorway for this voice-based stuff. In advertising and marketing, we're talking about this commerce era. And chat commerce is the buzzword that 2026 is probably going to be flooded with. What are your thoughts on chat commerce?
Yeah, I have seen some research and a lot of people prognosticating that actually voice is going to be the next interface that matters here for these AI tools. Again, to our point earlier about usability, ease of usability, instead of everybody sort of typing stuff. And I've been doing that for a long time. I take my Android phone and I turn on the recorder and I just talk to it. Take the transcript and shove that into ChatGPT or Gemini. Now, both of those have, you push the microphone, very good speech to text translation. I think Claude is a little bit behind on its ability to process speech, but it'll get there. And so, now as those tools get built and more popular and users get trained to interact with speech, now we get to the voice commerce era, which we all saw at the Computer Electronics CES show in Las Vegas a decade ago as the big hype and the big promise that never quite happened. And, I've got my Google devices and my Alexas in a box now sitting down here, no longer plugged in like I used to have every day. But I do think we're going to get to that point where, there are consumer shopping agents and then there are brand commerce agents. And so, this is the moment where my bots talk to your bots, so to speak. And I can just say, hey, here's a wedding invitation that I got. I can take a picture of it and say, it says, beach casual. I have no idea what that means, but here's the date of the wedding. You know my size. You know my budget. You know my style preferences. So you go figure it out. And whether that's from Ralph Lauren or whatever brand, and then I can say, and put it on whichever of my credit cards has the available balance this month to absorb that purchase. And the best points deal this month. And I think that's where we're going to get to because sort of let's face it, Samraj, e-commerce right now through left-hand navbar has not really evolved much over the past 15 years, right? I go to men's clothes, men's shirts on sale, men's dress shirts on sale, size medium, click, 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 right? Like, I would much rather tell the thing that I'm going to a wedding and let it find something for me. Maybe give me a last chance to a thumbs up, thumbs down, approve. But like, you go figure that out while I'm taking a walk with my dog.
Yeah, I do think that it gets a bit annoying having to select different filters. But also, I feel like websites in the future will be created in real time for each user. So the website will be dynamically changing because at the moment it's static with some dynamic elements. But I think the whole thing's going to be different. I don't even know if I think it's a URL bar is going to be there in the next 10, 15 years. I think it'll be very different where everything goes into the background and we just have this amazing interface thing where even my laptop, I can see MacBook Pro, it's got a lot of black design around the outside. Imagine if everything's just a pure screen in the future.
Yeah. And to their credit, Microsoft is kind of building for this sort of agentic web. Now, again, everybody, as I said earlier, the death of X, that's the death of the consumer web. No consumers will ever visit a website anymore. No, I think it's a yes and world. But, Satya Nadella is like really kind of investing in this sort of agentic web where I can now have it buy football tickets for me. I could have it book a vacation for me, and working on the plumbing on the back end to start to enable that future. And, whenever any of these big tech companies or all of these big tech companies get behind the technology and investment flows from venture capital that way. I do think that agentic web, agentic commerce, voice-based commerce is definitely in the cards moving forward.
Yeah, and the younger generation are going to be using these tools way more natively than you and I, right? Because they're growing up with it. And you're teaching the new generation. So what sort of questions are you getting from these guys?
Yeah, I think the use case for those kinds of tools will depend on three things. It will depend on the risk of the purchase. It will depend on my sort of competency of knowledge around the purchase, and then my enjoyment of the purchase, right? So if it's, reordering paper napkins for my kitchen, well, I don't enjoy that. I guess I know what a good napkin is, right? But there's low risk. So that kind of thing will outsource. On the other hand, I enjoy wristwatches. I know a lot about them. Yes, I mean, I guess it's a higher risk purchase, but I'm not going to outsource that because I'm competent in my own knowledge and I actually like doing it as a hobby. So, when I have this discussion with my students, right, that's often the case. If you enjoy it and you know about it, and or if it's low risk, then I actually don't want that outsourced because that reduces, the fancy word is my utility, right? My enjoyment around it. So, I think that's some of the conversations that we have. I think obviously, lots of the other conversations that we have in MBA classrooms now are what's the appropriate or inappropriate use of AI in education, in the classroom, for pre-career training to make sure that we send everybody out into the working world equipped with firsthand, hands-on knowledge of how to use these tools. Those are some of the things that we talk about in the MBA classroom these days.
And what sort of use cases have really surprised you with how people are using these tools?
Well, look, I mean, I think one of the first things that has come about, and I think it's a great positive, is in our MBA classroom and, at many of the schools around the world, it's now a multicultural classroom with people from all over the world. Perhaps, we teach in English, but English isn't your first, second, or even third language. And, in a traditional assignment, sort of your writing quality and your writing style would be part of the evaluation if you're going to make a marketing recommendation or write a marketing plan, as part of a class assignment. Well, that unconsciously or maybe consciously always biased in favor of native English speakers. Well, now, right, we encourage everyone, including native English speakers, to take the last pass of their assignment through an AI tool and say, you are the world's greatest copy editor. You know everything there is about style and punctuation and grammar and syntax. Read this. Don't change any of the ideas. Don't rewrite anything. Don't drop anything, but make it publication ready. And that greatly levels the playing field if you're, in school or working and not a native language speaker in the country where you're going to school or doing business. Now that brings everybody up to sort of the same level where it's now sort of not my language skills setting me apart anymore. It's like what's going on in my head, right, is now the equalizer. So, I mean, that's sort of one way that we encourage people to do that. The other way we encourage people to do that is use it as a sparring partner, right? If you have an idea for a new product, if you have an idea for a paper in class, if you have an idea for an assignment, again, use your voice recorder, spit that out and say, here's my starting point. Poke three holes in this. What am I missing? What's not good here, right? What are my blind spots? Of course, we all want to avoid the sycophantic responses from these LLMs. Oh, it's amazing. You're the brilliantest ever person, right? You use it as a sparring partner. And now if I spar with it on the front end, I develop the ideas myself in the middle and I use it as an editor at the back end. Wow, that really raises the level of work product.
Those are two really cool use cases. I like the one where they're making it publication ready because that's what I do a lot of the times. I'm like, don't change any of the wording. Just make the commas, etc., as organized as possible. Keep the word count the same. It's a really good kind of consultant, I'd say.
Yeah, for sure. And then, obviously we're teaching an AI and marketing class. I'm teaching that course and we're having students now actually hands-on building AI outputs. And so that's everything from, analyzing, you know, 10,000 rows of past consumer purchase data, and then trying to turn that into an AI-powered consumer customer segmentation. So, you know, we're using sort of K-means and factor analysis, factor reduction, all those kinds of things. And then from there, we're analyzing thousands of hours of focus group interviews to try and unpack and uncover some insights. We're now creating ideal customer personas, synthetic ICP, so you can chat with your customer. Then we use that to develop new product ideas. We vibe code apps and landing pages. We now use all these tools to create go-to-market assets, you know, display ads, video ads, etc. And then we use the AI tools to analyze post-campaign results. And so, you know, sort of the end-to-end marketing chain, like we've got everybody in there using these tools, building this stuff so that they can leave being sort of state-of-the-art AI-powered marketers.
That is really, really good. That is really, really good. I think it's very impressive because a lot of universities are not that advanced just yet with giving people hands-on knowledge and tools because there's so many tools out there.
Yep.
What are your favorite two or three tools?
Well, I mean, you know, I have open all day long here, obviously the big three frontier models. And, you know, we've used this term before, but maybe I realized I didn't quite get a chance to define it. Like, these are the three tools, the ChatGPT latest version, Claude latest version, Gemini latest version, that on sort of every test that we put these tools through, MMLU, Mensa tests from Norway, like whatever it is, like these score head and shoulders above the others. Use the best tools and know how to use them well. So I have paid versions of all three of those open all day long that I use. Those are certainly some of my favorites. At the same time, I play around with character AI. I was chatting, we were talking about Lyceum, right? I was chatting with Plato and with Socrates the other day, right? And which is like a mind blower. And then we invited Steve Jobs into that conversation too. Right. So, you know, these are, so I mentioned synthetic ideal customer personas. These are synthetic personas trained on everything Plato ever wrote, everything Aristotle ever wrote. And you can chat with them now. I mean, it's a mind blowing kind of a fun thing.
Yeah, that is crazy. And in particular, I think Aristotle and Steve Jobs in particular would be really good. Have you ever met Steve Jobs in real life?
Very early in my career, I had the pleasure of seeing him speak at a conference, didn't get a chance to meet, but you know, obviously one of the great business and visionary minds. We've all read his big, thick bio, and, you know, maybe there were some personal life issues, so we'll set that aside. But, you know, clearly in terms of, you know, we don't think of Steve Jobs as a marketer, but he actually was a very brilliant and prescient, great brand marketer.
What do you think he would think of where we are right now, and what would he want to innovate with?
Well, look, there were always, there's a video circling around, if you want, we can put it in the show notes, of Steve talking about how when he was going to school, he always would read great papers and great works from Freud or Aristotle and everybody, and he wanted to chat with them. And it's like, it's almost weird to see him talk about this in the 80s in the video. He said, you know, I wish I could bring them back to life in a way that I could talk to, type, chat with them. So he almost was kind of presciently predicting what we have now with these kinds of LLMs along the way. So I think he would be very excited by that. I mean, I think obviously, you know, we talked earlier about ease of use of the interface, and I think that's always been one of Apple's design philosophies, right? The technology should recede to the background, and the usability, the elegance, the simplicity of that should be in the foreground. And so, you know, I think, you know, he would be very much in line, if I dare humbly say, with my earlier comments of, you know, it is not about picking models, right? This is like, what do you want to get done today? And how can Apple AI help you do that in a seamless, easy to use, easy to engage with, friendly, approachable way? And so, you know, I think, you know, so that certainly would be his mantra. And obviously, you know, Tim Cook and the folks over at Apple continue that legacy. But, you know, Steve, right, he's always pushing hard. So probably even more so on that.
Yeah, he made us think in a different way. And speaking of thinking in a different way, I always end each episode with a question from the person I'm talking to the audience. So if you had any questions to ask the audience, to think about, to comment, to write on LinkedIn, wherever it may be, what would it be?
I would ask the audience to think differently about where you're applying AI. I see so many people that say, oh, well, for the easy stuff, for the non-important stuff, oh, yeah, I'll ask AI about that. But again, if you have for $19 a month, a PhD level, always on assistant that never gets tired, you should be using that for your toughest problems, not your easiest problems. And so maybe I might challenge everybody to think differently. I'll use Steve's, right? All right. AI should be at the center of the plate, helping you on the most difficult, most challenging, hardest problems. Don't just use it for ordering pizza, although you should try it for that. But it's not like a sideshow or a fun little thing. Right? You've got the world's greatest assistant. Put that assistant to work on your toughest problem.
I love that. I think everyone's going to like that question. I just want to say thanks for the time. Thanks for your amazing insights. Thanks for your energy and your humor and just everything from this episode is going to really, I think it's going to fly. So yeah, thanks a lot, Jim. And hopefully everyone listening can comment in the video and on Spotify, etc. It'd be great to hear your thoughts.
Good. Thanks, Amraj. Appreciate being here.